We in the astrobiology world have been very frustrated that people haven't gone out looking for life. There have been no life search missions since Viking. And one of my bosses said it'll be an act of Congress before we go and look for life. And sure enough, just recently, there was almost the equivalent of an act of Congress where a chairman of a House subcommittee pointed at NASA and said, "You'll go and look for life in the outer solar system." And NASA just went, "Ooh, let's go and look for life." So that has prompted a change, looking for life in the ocean worlds in the outer solar system. And this slide is of the outer planets of our solar system. One is called Enceladus, which is a little moon around Saturn. And recently the Cassini space probe in the last few years has flown through these plumes. They're big geysers that are blowing out of the moon. The moon is covered in ice. Underneath there's what we now know is liquid water under the ice. The ice is kept warm, or the water is kept warm from gravitational tidal forces. And the organics collected by the Cassini, or the samples collected by the Cassini space probe, is just chock-a-block full of organics. There's a lot of organics in it. And that is just like saying life. They're not small molecules, they're big. And that's kind of a sign that there could be potentially life. So finally, quite recently, as a result of Congress pointing the finger at NASA and saying, go and look for life in the outer solar system now, we have collaborated with the Applied Physics Laboratory at the Johns Hopkins University in Washington, and we've been working on a mission to Enceladus, which is a moon around Saturn, and around the south pole of Enceladus are these massive plumes of water which are spewing into space, it's calculated around 200 kilograms a second going into space. And in fact, the E-ring consists of particles of that plume around Saturn. And we know now from gravitational sensor that there's probably a 20-kilometre deep ocean under there. And the gravitational forces and the tidal forces have been calculated to provide an average temperature of 100 degrees Celsius at the bottom of the ocean. So it's pretty warm down there. There's probably a lot of hypothermal vents. And Enceladus, as I said earlier, detected a lot of complex organics. We don't really know what they are. We just measured the mass of them, the molecular weight. But it was a big surprise. So the idea is given that we found methane, that there may well be methane-eating microbes in the ocean. So, by the way, this is Enceladus here, compared to our moon. So he's only a little guy. He's only a little fella. So at the moment, he's quite popular. So unlike the Mars mission, where we've been working really hard to try and get to ice, Enceladus is quite nicely spewing ice out into space for us to grab free samples, and there they all are coming out. And they've been mapped quite a lot now and surveyed by the Cassini spacecraft. So why might Enceladus be important is that it might answer some questions as to where and how life started on Earth and elsewhere. So the questions are, did life start in comets? Is it in comets and brought to Earth? Did life start on Mars and be brought to Earth via meteorites? Did life start on land on Earth? And I'll come to that in a minute. Or did it start around hypothermal vents on Earth in the oceans? Of course, Mars had hypothermal vents and oceans at one stage. It was just like Earth several billion years ago. And it had land, and of course Enceladus doesn't have land and never did. It always was an ocean world. So the question is this might help us understand the origins of life in the solar system. And there are two kind of competing theories of life. One is that life started in hypothermal vents by this gentleman here, Mike Russell. And he, some years ago, provided, and there's a whole group of people, in fact many universities, working at demonstrating that life may have started around hypothermal vents. And there was another very fine gentleman here called Dave Deamer and his collaborator they believe life actually started on Earth, on land, in ponds or pools that are evaporating. And just recently, I talked with his collaborator, Kowai, and they're about to put out a publication in Scientific American, which more or less says that they feel they've cracked it. They actually feel they've demonstrated in the lab and the field that at least chemistry that follows Darwinian rules can come about through pools evaporating and then refilling with water and evaporating. And there's quite a chemical process in that, and it's very interesting. It's very elegant too. I was very, very taken to their argument. If you look for life, you know, we know there's life on Earth, we think, and we believe there might have been life. Certainly there might have been life on Mars in the past. And Enceladus, which is an ocean, which we don't know, but we know there's a lot of organics being thrown out into space. In fact, Enceladus right now is the most likely place to find life. The evidence is just pointing to it at the moment. Much more than Mars, which is just very... there's no direct evidence of life on Mars at the moment from a science point of view. Life on Earth, for example, could have come from an Earth-Mars exchange where a particular form of life, somewhat life on Mars and Earth would be very similar. If life came from a comet source and then the comets handed the organics to all the planets in the solar system, then life would be very similar between Enceladus, Mars and Earth. And if life started on land, then there'd be probably no life on Enceladus. There would be life on Mars, but it might be very different from life on Earth. I actually challenge that because I think there's been an exchange of life all the time going on between Earth and Mars, but it's probable that there would have been different. And then if life started in a sea vent, we could find life or evidence of life in all three places, and they might be all different, very different. So going for look for life will help us to understand the origin of life on Earth and in our solar system and, of course, elsewhere in the universe. And the kind of things we're looking for is amino acids. So life on Earth uses 20 amino acids, and 10 are found floating around in space, and the remaining 10 are made. Biology has made it, or something's made it. And I understand that there are up to 500 combinations of amino acids that you could have. So for some reason, life's chosen a particular set of 20. And it could be that life elsewhere uses amino acids as well, but they've chosen a slightly different set of 20 and so on. And that's one way of sensing life. If you've got a pile of organics and you've got a strong signal of 20 or so amino acids, then you think, well, that's quite unusual, very unusual. The other thing is creality, which life on Earth, its amino acids are left-handed. So you can in space, it's random. It can be either right-handed or left-handed. But the molecules on Earth for life are all left-handed. So why are we all... a lot of us are right-handed. I don't know whether that means anything, but... So life elsewhere could be all right-handed, or it could be all left-handed, or it could be a mixture. But if we found in a sample amino acids, all of which were one-handed or very dominated by that, then we would say, well, this is definitely a presence of life or an indicator of life. The other thing of life, generally life has very large organic molecules, and large organic molecules have been found coming out of Enceladus. And also, life prefers low-mass carbon isotopes. So those are the kind of things, between all of those, all together, that kind of suggests that there's life. And the only other way of knowing for sure is if you find something wriggling around in a microscope that's moving and laughing at you. And it's very difficult to convince scientists that there is life, of what life is and what it isn't, especially at this level, the level of molecules. So it's actually quite a tricky job. We unfortunately have no tricorder. We need one desperately, by the way, if you can make one. So my role in Enceladus is to do the capture. We plan to capture the ice in the plume. We plan to fly through the plume at about the speed of a jet plane and sweep in all the ice particles into one spot. And I've been using the fastest gun in the West, which is a big gun. It is, in fact, a gun that uses, I think, old World War II cannons. But it uses a .5 caliber shell that fires pellets, or a pellet, and can fire pellets, well, very lightweight ones, up to 7 kilometres per second. So it really is the fastest gun in the West. So we fire a pellet at an ice pie, which is at minus 180 degrees. We've dipped it in liquid nitrogen outside, and then we put it in inside the gun chamber, pump all the air out and fired the gun, and you get a plume, and the front end of the plume, these little particles are coming out at about the right speed and about the right size. And then we've been filming those going into our collector. So this is kind of how we've been designing our collector. There is apparently, I met an Australian to the day that I left to come to Australia. An Australian came in and he's working in a similar gun in Seattle. And he told me it's not as fast as ours, but it's got more Viagra. So, well, what can you say?